Sheldon Solomon is the guest on this week's The Limitless, the podcast between I am Jason Horsley and I am talking to Sheldon now.
There's a rock inside my chest.
Okay, so we're going to talk about terror and how to manage it and things that you're familiar with. We might talk about, might go into areas you're less familiar with. I thought it might be good to start, I mean, I've kind of an inversion because normally you're probably used to introducing yourself, but I thought it might actually be helpful to reintroduce myself so you have a sense of who the listeners are going to be.
Very good.
A couple of reasons. One being, you can feel free to just start running. I mean, whatever the expression is, land on your feet running. I mean, you don't have to give any of the, most of my listeners will be familiar, if not directly with your work, but with the basic psychology around it, partly or largely, because I've referred to it quite a bit, whether I've actually cited you or not. I think the basic principles are very sound and very useful. So they'll be mostly familiar with, so consider them at that level. The other reason is that most of my work, as you may not be familiar, is a kind of deep dive into the hidden aspects of society and culture and the areas of covert manipulation therein. So I call it social engineering, psychosocial engineering, cultural engineering, largely to distance myself from any branding such as AC theorist, which is now obviously quite disreputable these days, and I think in many cases with good reason. But I'm certainly I've done a lot of looking into the more nuanced aspects of that kind of long-term social control, let's say. So most of my listeners, that's their interest. So I guess I was saying this just in case there are things you normally wouldn't want to say. You can certainly feel free with my listeners. They're going to be very interested in your perspective on those kind of approaches. And I want to start actually with that because I've been listening to some of your recent interviews. And I noticed on at least two that the interviewer started to ask you about this or something, let's say, I'll unpack it in a second, but then they never really got to it. So I'm going to try and really get to it. And it's basically this terror management theory has the specific meaning that you have coined it with, which is to do with how the ways in which we manage our own terror of death. But it occurred to me before talking to you that actually one could flip it and see it as having a different meaning or an additional meaning, which is the use of people's terror to manage people. And it would seem as though your research has very much, tracked that, the ways in which people's terror affects them and that they come up with coping mechanisms to manage their terror, and thereby, and you have talked about this, I know, that people can themselves be manipulated by triggering their terror. So, as I say, I think interviews have kind of tried to get into that with you, but they never quite stayed on it. So I thought maybe we could start there. Like, have you, as part of your observation currently with the COVID and all this, obviously it's this great opportunity to observe terror management theory in action. Has part of it been not just to observe the ways in which people are managing their own terror, but also to see the ways in which groups and organizations and individuals are managing people's terror in order to pursue their own interests?
Wow. Jason, first of all, great to get to talk to you again.
Thanks.
I remember fondly my last stint. And great question that I frankly wish would arise more often. You're quite right to note that terror management theory was originally formulated with regard to the individual and how they come to terms with the reality of the human condition and manage existential terror by, you know, embracing cultural worldviews and seeking self-esteem. But you make a great point that was also a central preoccupation of Ernest Becker, and he's where he's the cultural anthropologist who wrote the book The Denial of Death, and that's where we got our ideas from. And he was keenly interested in how certain kinds of political leaders particularly are extraordinarily agile, business ones too, for that matter, at least free market capitalists, that it is absolutely essential, one could argue, that you need to harness and channel existential terror in order to keep people wanting to buy shit that they don't need. And so in a sense, that's the key to unregulated capital-based economies, which collapse the minute people don't keep buying stuff. And so one way that that existential terror is exploited on a daily basis is through bombarding people with all kinds of messages, implicit and not so implicit, about how if you're a person of value in our culture, it's because you look a particular way or because you have a particular prestigious object or because you compare favorably with those around you. And so there's one sense in which, you know, all of commercial life, one could argue, it is one ginormous effort to keep people, whether they're aware of it or not, perpetually terrified by relentlessly challenging their self-esteem by saying, oh, if you look old, you're no good. If you look poor, you're no good. If you don't have the iPhone 12 or whatever number they're now on, you're no good. So I would say that that's one way that existential anxieties are routinely exploited. And to me, that's rather sinister, because what I would argue is that we need death anxiety in order to maintain an economic system based on the supposition that infinite growth is both possible and desirable. Another area that I'm very much preoccupied with these days with respect to the exploitation of existential anxieties to manipulate folks is in the political domain. One of Becker's central interests in The Denial of Death and in his book Escape from Evil was how is it that fascist slash populist slash charismatic leaders come to power. I'm going to use all of those terms as functionally equivalent, because basically, following Max Weber, the German sociologist, he just said, look, in times of historical upheaval, when existential anxieties are apt to be quite prominent, that we become attached to a certain kind of political leader. Weber called those leaders charismatic, seemingly larger than life individuals who believe, or who their followers believe, are divinely ordained to rid the world of evil. And Weber's point was that what underlies our passion for embracing such leaders in difficult times is ultimately existential anxiety. And what Becker said is, you know, let's not mince words, let's just call it death anxiety. So at the beginning of Hitler's terms in Germany, or rather after World War One, you've got Germany falling apart, humiliated by the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. And here you've got Hitler, you know, literally a clown, but a very able and politically astute clown who just said, only I can make Germany safe again. And what he did is very standard in terms of fascist leaders. What you need to do, like an alchemist of hate, is you need to take existential anxieties, you need to take fear, whether people are aware of it or not, and then you've got to transform it into rage by directing attention to another group of individuals that you designate as the all-encompassing repositories of evil, the eradication of which would make life on Earth as it's purported to be in heaven. And that's really the formula. And I think it was Goebbels at the Nuremberg trial who just said, look, it's really easy to manipulate people. And the way that you do it is you threaten them. You just say, look, there's people that are threatening us, and you just accuse the opposite party of being pacifists. And Goebbels just said it works that way every time. And I think, sure enough, that history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. I can't remember who said that, but, you know, the tragic repetition was in 2001, in the aftermath of the events of September 11th. We had President George W. Bush back in the day. And 2 days before September 11th, he had the lowest approval rating in the history of presidential polling. 3 weeks later, he had the highest approval rating after saying that we will rid the world of the evildoers and that he believed that God had chosen him to lead the country in this perilous time. And so we did a lot of experiments back in the day, and they're very simple studies. We remind some people that they're going to die by asking them to write about their own death, or by interviewing them in front of a funeral parlor, or maybe blasting the word death for 28 milliseconds on a computer screen so fast that you don't even know that you've been exposed to it. And then we ask people to just rate their enthusiasm for President Bush, or at the time, Senator Kerry, who was running against him in 2004. And in 10 or 12 studies, what we found is that Americans didn't care for President Bush all that much in a psychologically benign state of mind. But in other conditions where people were reminded of their mortality first, then they liked Bush a whole lot more. I fast forward to 2015 when Donald Trump tumbles down the escalator and declares that he is the only one who can keep us safe from the hordes and the gluttonous immigrants storming the southern border, or Islamic terrorists parachuting into Buffalo to rape our women and steal our chicken wings, or the Chinese rapists and so on and so forth. And Trump did the same thing as the Hitlers and to a lesser extent, the Bushes of the world. He took existing existential anxieties and directed his followers to churn their fears into hate. He doesn't say it that way, but basically he gave people plenty of folks to hate, foremost amongst them Muslims and immigrants. And sure enough, Steve Bannon, who's basically Trump's Goebbels, he said in an interview in 2017, look, people don't vote because of a rational consideration of the issues. They vote because of fear and anger. And he said, you know, slogans won the last election. Lock her up, build the wall, make America great again. Well, in response to your question, finally, Jason, I see right now the active use of existential anxieties every day. I see President Trump, whether he's aware of it or not, actively exploiting existential fears and that are magnified in the wake of the pandemic in order to maintain his rather shaky status vis-a-vis being reelected. We've also done studies where we've shown that just asking an American to think about an immigrant moving into their town or a mosque being built in their neighborhood, that's sufficient to increase unconscious death thoughts, and that in turn, it increases support for President Trump. Same thing with the disaster in Minnesota a couple of days ago that's now playing out in the U.S. This was a made for HBO, not to sound glib. This is a great example for the president to exploit basically white rage, white fear turned into white rage. And so my long-winded short answer to your great question is yes, I see what's going on right now in the world. Just a bouillabaisse of subtle and not so subtle efforts to harness existential terror, primarily for malevolent commercial and political gain.
Right. Well, I'm going to have a long answer that hopefully will end on a question. It'll take some gymnastics here, but you chose the Nazis and then you chose Trump of examples of the thing I was asking about, manipulation, social control through fear. And I wouldn't disagree with any of that. However, the research that I've done in the last couple of books I've wrote, it's something that's very widespread, and we mentioned a time of existential anxiety. We could say the whole of the 20th century was that time. So what I've observed is that actually this kind of principle, it's easier to see writ large with the demagogues and the charismatic leaders like Hitler or Trump, but it's also going on with the, in less obvious or overt ways, throughout political machinations. So, for example, I mapped the Fabian Society in my own country, in Britain, in the 20th century, which includes people such as George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells, and people that I used to think of as these cultural heroes, but they also seemed to be involved. They were interested in eugenics, and they were involved in formulating strategies for manipulating the masses as a ruling elite. So it seems to me it's a sort of a consistent thing throughout political history, at least for the last couple hundred years. So I guess here's my question is, are you aware that there could be a sort of ironic danger if we paint it with too broad a stroke, that we might scapegoat the scapegoaters and thereby play into that machinery? Because is it really Trump or Hitler? Or, I mean, because was Obama that different, or was he the good cop to Trump's bad cop, you know, and that we're being...
Oh, great. Yeah. No, this is awesome, Jason. And I want to have it both ways, even though, you know, sometimes you can't. I think Trump, who I not so fondly refer to as Orange Hitler, is a unique danger. Do you know the black swan notion, you know, that every once in a while, I can't remember whose idea this is, but it's just this idea that, you know, every once in a while, the improbable will happen. And like I call Trump the orange swan, because I think he is a product of a particular historical moment. And I find him to be of singular danger. Now, at the risk of sounding histrionic, I think that there's a real sense in which he is in a position to literally, you know, like pull the string out of a ball of string that unravels the entire world. You know, maybe I've just been hunkered down in my house for too long, but I don't think there's ever been a more dangerously incapable person in a position of power and influence than Trump. Moreover, I think he's Hitler on steroids. He's got all of Hitler's knack for how to use fear, loathing, and lying for malevolent ends. And on top of that, he's got the internet, and he's got Fox News, and he's got, you know, Twitter and Facebook. And so America was already on the ropes. I like how Frank Zappa said it when Reagan was elected in 1980, the American public treats intelligent behavior as if it was some sort of hideous physical deformity. So here you got this, Americans have a long tradition of hostility to intelligence. And so we're functionally illiterate. We're not very good at being citizens of a democracy. And so here you got Trump coming along. And in a sense, I think, as Stephen Hawking put it right before he died, Trump, bad man. All right, but I like your point, which is that there is a real danger of mistaking. I see Trump as just a bag of pus on an infected organism. And there's a real danger of thinking if I can pop the pustule and get rid of this fucking 55-gallon drum of orange pus, that the problem is solved, when in fact, no, the infection remains. And you do, but you make a very fine point. I do think, for what it's worth, and I could be wrong, that it's not inconsistent to say, on the one hand, that he poses a singular danger, and that I think step one in any effort to foster social progress is to get him out of office. And I think this is it's a pressing need for the entire world. But having said that, that in and of itself will do nothing, because I do think a case could be made that the entire world is a seething cauldron of existential anxieties. That might be true always, but at this particular historical moment, when there's a confluence of existential concerns, you know, everything from the virus to the environment to economic instability to rampant levels of psychological disorders, we've got all of these things that are swirling in the mist. And so you're right, even without Trump, there will be no shortage of folks who willfully or not will take over the unfortunate role of taking it upon themselves to manage other people's anxieties in ways to benefit them.
I think it's a question of where we're willing to let the buck stop, or if we're willing to let the buck keep going until it lands on us and our complicity. Because you could say, well, and we would have to say, that Trump, even if he does present a real and present danger, more than just a pus boil would, let's say, unless it was filled with acid, I suppose. And then you'd have to be very careful about taking him down then, wouldn't you?
There you go.
But anyway, Trump himself is only in power, just as Hitler was, because of a certain portion of the population that was behind him. I'm not saying that there weren't hidden strings, like the Bank of England was backing Hitler and so on. There's a geopolitical and a parapolitical element, but it does still require the energetic support of a people. And what tends to happen around Trump is that a certain faction blames Trump, and then they blame all the people that supported Trump, so the buck then stops with Trump and his followers. But I would say that that's still scapegoating. I think it's clearly in evidence with the kind of, they call it Trump derangement syndrome, this hysterical reaction against Trump, which isn't going to be helping to deal with the problem. Whereas it seems to me that terror management theory is rooted in a much deeper discipline, which is psychology, and the psychology of whole populations.
That's
which
right.
Of course, made up of individuals. And in that regard, any kind of pathology that we see, coming to a red flaming head or an orange head in the case of Trump, is sourced in the whole, in a collective pathology that's more latent, in most of us, but it's still there.
No, absolutely good point. It's good to be reminded of it, myself included. I'm preoccupied these days with Trump's malevolence, because I do find it to be extraordinary. And yet, there is the real danger. We called it at some point, or maybe Becker did, terror focalization. Or negative transference is another term, where you just take all of your own existential anxieties and pin them on, somebody who you just then see as the embodiment of evil. So, yeah, it is quite likely that well-intentioned people, including myself, are ironically using Trump to manage our own existential anxieties by blaming everything from the virus to the weather to why my newspaper came late this morning on him.
It's ironic because it makes us all so easy to manipulate.
That's right.
In that regard, so a tyrant can even use our loathing of them to manipulate us. I wanted to bring up, well, I guess to continue to stitch these two things together, the question of whether death itself can become a scapegoat, insofar as to what extent is, you know, our fear of death rooted in a lack of awareness of what death is. In other words, it's kind of a mask for the fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
Because then it spreads into everything, doesn't it? I mean, death seems like, that's why I said maybe it's like a scapegoat in a certain sense. We don't want to think about death, but when we do, or when we start mapping our anxiety, we could say, oh, it's all about death. But in actual fact, as you know, our anxiety gets triggered by just about everything. And the one common element seems to be in things that trigger us is something that we can't comprehend.
Yes. I think that's a good point. I've just become aware of a
state of emergency.
Pardon me?
I thought you say they've declared a state of emergency.
No, you have to go. I was just going to say that I've just run into the work of a fellow named Stephen Jenkinson. Have you heard of his work?
No.
So he's a Canadian, interesting guy. He's a social worker and a philosopher, and he's worked in hospice settings. And he has some very interesting ideas along these lines. And he argues, and I think makes a good case for a point that's compatible with yours, Jason, and that's just the idea that our concerns about death are filtered through our particular culture's conception of it.
Right.
And because we are such a death-denying culture, it may be the case that, rather ironically, this magnifies our concerns about death, because we routinely, psychologically speaking, either consciously or unconsciously, confuse and conflate death with a general uncertainty. So I think that's a great point.
So of course this is why the religion is the panacea to death, because it replaces uncertainty with certainty, but it doesn't hold up in time. Well, I guess I don't know exactly how to say this, but it certainly doesn't hold up for some of us, right?
That's
because
right.
Because it seems like a false certainty.
Yeah.
And whereas go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. It's hard. It's hard for people like myself that are kind of secular types. It's hard to imagine how that would assuage my existential concerns. But I hope I'm humble enough to not belittle the prospect that it might do quite well for others.
It does seem to, up to a point, but it does seem to, I mean, this is part of terror management theory, is that it's not, there's a dogmatism to it, or a particular kind of dogmatism, which reacts badly when not only questioned, but when presented with alternate beliefs. And that, as we all know from experience, is the mark of a fanatic, somebody who isn't really sure of their belief.
No, that's right. And of course, therein lies the problem, and also the explanation for why, not to tie everything back to the political moment, but I think that's the best explanation for why the strongest support for President Trump in the U.S. is from religious fundamentalists. I think it's an overlapping psychological dynamic. On the other hand, I like Gordon Allport's distinction between like intrinsic and extrinsic religiosity. You know, some people are religious in a very dogmatic sense, and I would argue, like Heidegger does, that you know, that's just a flight from death. On the other hand, you know, some folks' religiosity is a more quest-like, not particularly dogmatic view of the world. And those folks don't respond defensively, for example, when they're reminded of their mortality. So I see it the same. You know, there's some atheists that are just as dogmatic as their fundamentalist counterparts. Others a bit more ecumenical. But therein lies the conundrum, is that most things that give us absolute certainty do so at quite the price, which is a radical intolerance of those who don't adhere to our views.
Well, I came up with a phrase recently, it might interest you, not that recently, actually. In 2013, I was working on this book, Prisoner Infinity, about Whitley Strieber, who believes he's an alien abductee. And I used to believe him too, because I was quite into that stuff. But the more I looked into it, the more inconsistencies I found, and the more evidence for some sort of human manipulation that was quite sinister. Anyway, I only lay all that on you, because the term I hit upon was crucial fiction.
Nice.
As in a story that we tell ourselves that's absolutely crucial for our psychological survival. And so as soon as somebody starts to point the holes out in that story, our whole sense of identity comes under threat. And so we will fight to the death to protect it and defend it. And consistent with that, we will constantly paper over the cracks in our own story. So it's like we've got selective amnesia. We won't notice all the inconsistencies.
Oh, I love that. I love that phrase, Jason. Ernest Becker has one that's not quite as elegant in his early book, The Birth and Death of Meaning. He talks about our culturally constructed belief systems as necessary lies. Yeah. And then he refers to a psychiatrist, Alan Wheelis, who wrote a book called The Scheme of Things. And Wheelis has a point of view along your lines, which is these are quite necessary. And it is relatively easy for, you know, our necessary fictions or schemes of things to be undermined by a variety of events. And yeah, when that happens, psychological dis-ease is the inevitable result.
Yeah. So where I'm wondering we could go here is how much of the of death anxiety isn't so much about physical death as about mind death or identity death, the feeling of being annihilated.
Yeah.
Because one is invested into an illusory idea of who we are.
Yeah. So I'll be an egghead here and just say that the people who study this for a living argue that death is indeed a complex, multidimensional construct, and that people vary with regard to the extent to which different aspects of death are concern them. So some folks are concerned primarily about the bodily aspects of death, and what bothers them, you know, is the idea that their carcass is just going to degenerate into a smoldering heap and that worms are going to crawl out of your eyeballs. Other folks are more concerned about death as the annihilation of the self or the ego. Other folks are more concerned about the interpersonal implications of death, the shattering of our relationships with the people around us that matter to us. Other folks are more concerned about what Robert J. Lifton would call symbolic immortality, or Eric Erickson would call generativity. And this is just the idea that, that we're going to die with either literally or symbolically unfinished business. We were going to do something, and that it was going to be good for humanity. Maybe it wouldn't make us rich or famous, but it'd be something of enduring value. And there is research, and I think it's pretty good, that suggests that you can measure death anxiety along these different dimensions, and you can show that, that depending upon what is of specific concern to particular people, that's what makes them respond defensively.
Right. I just thought of a wrinkle, not in your theory really, but in the idea that religious belief is a buffer against death, because if you're a Christian, you believe in hell, and so there could be an even more profound terror of death if you're a Christian who believes that you might go to hell. I mean, is that have you factored that into your charts?
Yeah, you know, I haven't. I've been wrestling with that idea for quite some time. It just seems, to be silly to the point of using a bad pun, yeah, it seems like a hellish predicament to be in.
Absolutely.
to be on Earth yearning for a perpetual afterlife with the coincident recognition that it might not end well.
Yeah. And there's no way out. I mean, there's no small print in the Christian contract generally. Once you're in hell, that's I should laugh. I mean, this is the things I map with Prisoner Infinity, is it seemed to me even with secular people there are different forms of belief, and I'll tell you about my own if you want at some point. That makes death seem like a terrifying prospect, not because of the end of life only, but because of the possible afterlife or the possible unresolved stuff that we're going to have to face, and how this can be an even more driving pathology than simply fear of non-existence.
Wow. Yeah. I like how you think about these things. I'm going to scribble that down because that's actually an incredibly subtle and counterintuitive point that we may be able to test somehow. This is just the egghead academic image. Yeah. But yeah, I hear you proposing. And the risk is sounding glib. It's a great, crazy idea, which is that for some people, there are things worse than death.
Absolutely. Well, the Inquisition is coming to mind. I mean, how we don't really know how devout those Catholics were, but they certainly used their belief in God and in hell as a justification for the most horrendous, you know, barbarisms.
Yeah, wow.
So it's commonly, and I mean, there's a particularly in our secular age now, and the anti-patriarchal liberal view that religion is the root of all evil, practically. That's a common viewpoint, but it's not very nuanced, and I've never heard somebody say, well, belief in hell very much is likely to generate all kinds of evil behaviors, because A, you'd do absolutely anything to avoid it. B, if you really believe it's a possibility, it would drive you mad over time. I mean, not to mention the contradiction of an all-loving God that's going to send you to hell. Anyway.
Yeah. Wow. All right, I'm going to think about that.
For hitting you with so much stuff. It's just you've got me thinking. I'll get us back on familiar ground, hopefully familiar ground. Are you familiar with the term false ceremony masters?
No.
Okay, so the context, I think you will be, the context is liminality. So it's Victor Turner as the anthropologist.
Oh, okay, love Victor Turner, go.
Okay, and then of course René Girard, he didn't do a lot of writing about liminality, but it's a similar landscape that Girard was mapping in terms of mimetic violence and scapegoating and how we deal with, the overwhelming fear of death and of the unknown. And I think with what Victor Turner, I think, was discovering via his anthropological work was that that liminality, periods of liminality were inevitable in communities, but they were also necessary and they were also useful, they were productive. And
absolutely.
So they would actually generate periods of liminality. I mean, now we have this debasement of it with something like Mardi Gras or, just times where it's sort of very Dionysian and there's a free-for-all or even rock concerts and whatnot.
Yes.
But what Turner was talking about was actually a way for communities to transform and therefore evolve, not to destroy themselves. And so they would create periods of liminality where all bets were off, all the rules, the social etiquettes were suspended. And say specific example would be for young people who are coming of age, there would be a period of a week or something when the whole village would be in liminality. And so these young people who are having to come of age were able to express all of their adolescent angst and all the rest of it, knowing they wouldn't be punished. But there would be these ceremony masters who were there to guide them through it, so they wouldn't completely lose, their marbles. And the general idea, anyway, is that when old structures, whether it's psychological in terms of adolescence, or in larger community, are starting to crumble, then you create a space for that to happen within, and more importantly, from which new structures can emerge spontaneously, rather than imposing new structures on as a way to try and just manage the terror. And I bring it up now because I think we've lost all that sense.
Absolutely.
That kind of basic principles of psychology and community. And I'm not entirely sure who coined the term false ceremony masters. Could have even been me, I don't know, but I don't think so. But anyway, the idea is that as the knowledge of this gets debased and or kind of hoarded by elites who use it to their own ends, false ceremony masters can insert themselves into societies that are in a state of liminality, and then they will perpetuate liminality, because as long as a society is in that state of chaos, they're constantly, as you've observed, they're looking for charismatic leaders.
Yeah.
And so then that state of chaos empowers the false ceremony masters. And I mean, I guess the underlying question here, or the point, bring it back to this point of uncertainty, that I think, you know, any kind of uncertainty can be used in the same way that you've observed with the fear of death, to keep people in this constant state of anxiety where they constantly need something that will reinforce their certainty about existence.
Wow, again, great point. Not to bring everything back to Trump in the moment, but he's like Orange Burning Man in that regard. And I think the Trump rally is, you know, very close to a kind of a liminal outburst. It really is a seething cauldron of, you know, a momentary cessation of everything.
Of reason, yeah. And Trump even embodies that. I mean, he's, because the trickster is the liminal figure.
That's right. So I think that, and of course, this need not always be malevolent. And, you know, that Victor Turner certainly didn't see it that way. Wow. That's a fine point. And, you know, I can't remember if it was Nietzsche, you know, when it's, what is it, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, when he's like, oh, we have to reevaluate all values. And, you know, Nietzsche was down with the idea that things were going to have to fall apart before there was the possibility of, you know, some sort of radical transformation that might ultimately prove to be better. You know, that was this whole thing in the gay science, you know, when he's like in the 1880s, he's like, God is dead. You know, but I tell people, you got to read the rest of the paragraph, because he goes on to say Christianity has become unbelievable. And his point was just that the prevailing worldviews, the Judeo-Christian tradition that had kind of sustained people for thousands of years, was no longer compelling. And that he said it was going to take 200 years of feverish groping and rather stark chaos before we hopefully stumble into a new world, which is not guaranteed to be better. But then again, it sure might be. And, you know, maybe that's could be grounds for hope. You know, it took you know, two world wars and a depression, you know, to get the United States to its peak, you know, the kind of the New Deal. And, you know, for a couple of years, at least for white people, things were pretty good. And maybe it will take another depression plus, you know, worldwide pandemic. Plus, I hope to be wrong here, but we sure look like we're in the early rounds of the next world war, the way we seem to be throwing some sucker punches at China and so on. And it will be an interestingly turbulent next few years, I suspect.
You know, that's a Chinese curse, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Do you think that, I mean, how much do you factor in as a source of our growing anxiety, this, the global village that Marshall McLuhan predicted, and that we're all connected in this technological and therefore rather superficial sense, and social media certainly doesn't bring out the best in people. So I don't mean connected in any true community sense, but we're all increasingly aware of being part of a global system, and therefore of differences between us, and of the growing tensions. And do you see that as something that's exponentially just building?
Oh, absolutely. I think McLuhan, we need to start paying attention. I think that the like anything, the medium is the message. The technology is neither good nor bad, but it can certainly have unintended malevolent consequences. And do you know Star Trek? You watch any Star Trek movies?
Not the movies, but the original TV
All right, what about
show.
the
Yeah.
show? You know the Borg?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's in the second generation, next generation. But yeah, of course I know the Borg. Yeah.
Right. It's not as good as the original, but I think that I think a case could be made that we're no longer autonomous individuals, that the internet has lobotomized most people and rendered us giant interneurons through which ideas flow. And that it is really a different world. I mean, to be to be trite but right, you know, for most of human history, if a tidal wave took out 250,000 people in Indonesia, it's not going to bother me in upstate New York. I'll know nothing about it. And similarly, if there's a person of color gets killed in Minnesota, I'll also not know anything about it. And so, yeah, to be interconnected in, as you put it a few seconds ago, Jason, in a very superficial fashion, I think has just made people just carbon-based conduits in an international network of affect that's getting pushed around the world, multiplying certain ideas in ways that then ramps up the affect. It is somewhat ironic, almost science fiction-y, that here we are in principle with direct access to all the information in the world, and at no point in history could one could argue have more people been genuinely misinformed. So yeah, I think that's, we're in an odd moment historically.
Time has come for us to get down and boogie.
Can you say a bit more about affect there, because you're using it as a key. I mean, it's a key word in what you've been saying, and I think it's an insufficiently understood concept, affect, I would say.
Yeah, I would also. I've been, since I talked to you last, I've been reading Heidegger a lot. I don't know how familiar you are with his work.
Hardly.
Yeah, you know, the guy's a Nazi, so it bothered me for 40 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I avoided it, but Nazis are people too, and I'm finding a lot of his ideas to be quite compelling. And I'm interested because the ideas I like of his most, the philosophers don't like, including one of them is just the idea that basically not only that everything is affectively tinged. You know, I don't know his exact jargon, but he talks about we're always in a mood. We're not necessarily aware of that. But not only are we as individuals in moods, but we are in a psychosocial field. You know, we're situated in time and space and surrounded by an affectively laden environment that impinges upon us at all times. And, you know, his point, and it's one that he's getting from Nietzsche, is, you know, and Freud, of course, and that's that all of these things happen quite below the level of explicit awareness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so basically our conscious subjective experience is just the tail end of a series of affectively laden, non-linguistic affectations that drive us. And, you know, basically by the time we're saying, oh, here's how I feel, you know, that's probably at best a half-ass classic comic book summary of what's actually going on that underlies that.
Right. So our original experience in the womb and then in those early years is all affect.
Exactly.
Right. So, but our bodies are just perceiving and absorbing and sucking up experience, some of it's traumatic, and maybe we'll get to this. I would like to talk to you about trauma, but my point here is just that it's the primary mode for us as organisms of perceiving, and then we learn to add layers to that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, and those layers. Oh, so well, let's bring this back to death then, because I know you have this Camus quote that you like. Come to terms with your death, and thereafter everything is possible.
Yeah, I do like that.
And last time I heard you say it, which is today, it occurred to me that, I mean, what does that mean, come to terms with death? Or how would one do that? How would one say, I'm going to come to terms with death?
Yeah.
You know? What are the steps? And that led me to think, well, maybe is the problem not our fear of death, but what has caused our fear of death? In other words, what I'm trying to say, I don't say it too clumsily, but that is there something wrong in our relationship to our bodies and to our environment that has generated this fear of death? And therefore, we can't just bootstrap our way out of it. We can't just recalibrate our thinking. There's something in our bodies that somehow installed itself whereby we have an unnatural fear of death, right? Because if we're an animal, we're the only animal that fears death conceptually. So
yes,
what happened? Have you thought about that? Like, what went
no,
wrong?
That, I think that's right. I think you've, at least from my perspective, Jason, you nailed it. And that's that it may not be practical or necessary to come to terms with death by sitting in your room thinking about, okay, I'm going to die until I feel, all right, that's okay.
Okay.
And I like the Otto Rank dude who Becker was fond of. And he's like, yeah, no, you know, the flip side of fear of death is fear of life. Hmm. And that in turn has to do with our refusal to accept that we're embodied creatures.
Right.
And I think you make a very fine point in that regard. I just have been reading a book by a philosopher, an Italian philosopher named Sylvia Benso, and she writes about embodied wisdom. And I think it's an interesting idea, which is that, and another guy I like, Norman Brown, who Becker's a big fan of.
I was just going to ask you about him. Yeah, Love and Death.
Yeah, and Life Against Death.
Life Against
that,
Death.
That's Brown's entire project. He's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, we're groping for solutions as if this is a universal problem. But as you just pointed out, you know, the trees in my yard and my dog laying next to me seem unperturbed by the prospect of, you know, their transience and finitude. Yeah. And so in a very real sense, even if this may seem like common sense, you know, masquerading as psychological insight, most of us have had at least fleeting moments in our lives where, for all intents and purposes, we are momentarily detached, you know, from the usual vagaries of time and space, to the point where, you know, at least phenomenologically, we get to partake of a blissful state of eternity, which, as the theologians remind us, is not an amount of time. Right. And this is, of course, the way that it is for most life, where, you know, it's always now. And where, as Goethe put it, where the purpose of life is living. And rather than going through these extraordinary existential excruciations about what it means to be alive, another approach is to render the issue of meaning meaningless, but by noting that it never arises in most forms of life.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten there yet, by the way, but I like that idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just staying on the semantics for a moment, I'd like to get back to Brown, though, as well. But it occurred to me recently, and this is an intellectual exercise, but I do think that the intellect eventually does catch up with truth some of the time. And this is that this whole thing that is life meaningful, or people, you know, the fear that life is meaningless, it cancels itself out. Because if anyone were to say life is meaningless, they would then be saying a meaningless statement.
Yes.
Because if life was meaningless, then nothing would have meaning, including, right? So little things like that, one can arrive at them and realize that, as I think you were saying in your way, that the meaning of life is in living. It's not in thinking about living.
Exactly.
And it's self-evident.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious with the bees and the birds, to use the cliche, that they have purpose, right? It's just human. And we look at humans, we think, oh, God. That, you know, I mean, there's the rather, it's a bit cruel, but the Walmart people of Walmart website, but whatever it is, and for some people it's Trump supporters, but we look at portions of humanity. I work in a thrift store, so I see, you know, the dregs of humanity every day, and it's helping me develop compassion. But it certainly is driving home how purposeless human beings have become. And yet I think that's itself proof that we have a purpose, if you see what I mean, because it's compared to something, isn't it? When we see humans or our own life as without purpose, then it indicates that there is a purpose that we've...
Yes, I like that.
Yeah. Bring it back to Norman Brown then, because I think this is really a key thing. As I remember, and that book was very impacted me very much, and I incorporated it into Prisoner of Infinity, in fact. It was one of the key texts. One of his propositions was that if we were to become fully embodied, we would no longer fear death. Do you remember that
as a
proposition? Because that seems to be what you were saying. So I don't know if you've got something more to say about that. Because I know I do, but I don't want to crowd you with my own thoughts.
No, I want to hear your thoughts. Give me your view.
Well, no, I want to hear yours first, because mine might get out of hand. I mean, what's your sense of what an embodied life is, or and what prevents us from being embodied?
Yeah. All right. Well, so my view, what I remember when when I first read Life Against Death, I thought that was, it was great. You know, it was the end of the book. It's inspired and uplifting.
Yeah.
And then I read, Becker's Denial of Death, where in the last chapter, and he's a big fan of Norman Brown's, but he just says that's not, it's not possible.
Right.
Because, it would require a complete absence of repression, and which would render us perpetually debilitated, not only by the prospect of existential terror, but you can be overwhelmed with awe also. So Becker is very skeptical about the prospect of being completely unrepressed and or completely eliminating death anxiety. Having said that, though, I don't see why we have to see this as a binary condition where you're either embodied or not, as opposed to a continuum moving towards, in theory, a reintegration of embodied wisdom, for lack of a better term. And I don't see why we can't argue both theoretically and empirically that moving in that direction fosters, at the risk of being corny, personal growth and social progress. I see that as something we can aim for, even if it is an abstract ideal to be approximated but never attained. I don't know if that makes sense, but that would be
it made perfect sense. And it's ironic, that point about being an abstract ideal, because of course it would be that extent that we were disembodied, right?
Right.
Whereas as for your dog or my cat, that are we presume fully embodied, they don't even have the abstract ideal of it, because there's nothing to compare it to. That's life. So then I'll bring it to the second part of the question then, and maybe answer it too for myself, which is what prevents embodiment for human beings, and my short answer to that is trauma. And a slightly longer answer is that that my sense, and I don't remember my childhood and I don't remember the womb, of course, but I know it was an adverse environment, that there's something about human beings when neotenous, if you know that term, so that means a much longer brain development and so on.
Absolutely.
It takes us a lot longer to get fully in our bodies, for our consciousness to develop and our sense of self, because human beings develop a sense of self that animals don't, and a sense of being individual self. Well, this was supposed to be my short answer, wasn't it? Just that the life force, it seems to me, it's natural trajectory from conception to birth, and then maybe in those first couple of years where the child is still bonded with the mother and is gradually individuating, that the life force is supposed to become consciously distributed through the body, so that at a certain point we just become conscious of existing as individual selves who are going to die, but that's simultaneous with being fully embodied. So it's a bodily wisdom, as you put it, rather than this mental thing. But the trauma interjects there, and that trauma causes this dissociation where we go off into this mind realm, because what's happening to the body is so terrifying, we don't want our consciousness to be there. So it either withdraws or it doesn't continue to land. And so then we just have this, the life force only gets down to our eyes or something. I imagine it could be measured if we were sufficiently interested to try, but we're not, of course. And so the rest of our body is just kind of this appendage that we train like a dog to carry our foreheads around. Anyway, that's my not short answer.
It's perfect. I like that explanation. It's very Otto Rank-like, and also very coincident with current evolutionary takes, because, and actually it's just Freud, because he early on focused on neoteny and pointed out that this is the price that we pay for our vast intelligence. So basically you had Darwin saying, no animal is born more profoundly helpless and immature than the human infant. That in turn makes it such that, and you have to be born premature to get through the human birth canal. One of the unintended consequences of upright bipedalism was the constriction of women's hips. So all human babies are preemies, but then our brain develops over time in response to experience that gives us our neuroplasticity and, you know, amazing levels of imagination and creativity, all good. But as Freud pointed out, the downside is our extraordinary proneness to anxiety, which, while unpleasant, is also quite adaptive. Any non-anxious baby is probably eliminated from the gene pool rather early because for most of human history, made a lot of evolutionary sense to be anxious. You know, if you're 6 weeks old and you're hungry, you know, you can't get on DoorDash for pizza delivery, but you can't scream. And so, you know, the argument is that, you know, and that's why Nietzsche called us the disease called man, that, you know, no creature is in this precarious existential condition of having high levels of anxiety as the price that we pay for our vast intelligence. But as you put it, but very ably, and this is what my buddy Tom is studying more directly now, and that's that, yeah, the anxiety and John Bowlby, the guy who did attachment theory, he called it raw, undifferentiated terror. He just said it is, being a kid is hard. It's not all, you know, Walt Disney and milk and cookies. It's rife with anxieties. And that, basically almost all of us to some degree or another have had extensive bouts of dissociated states, which we try to manage in part by detaching ourselves from our bodies. You know, the whole Western Cartesian dualism, the mind-body split, is just a great example of a death anxiety-induced alienation from our physical carcass.
Mm-hmm. I presume you're familiar with transhumanism as this growing movement of technologically boosted disembodiment. And now this is occurring to me earlier when you were talking about the religion, the tendency of religious people to look to charismatic leaders. And I was thinking, well, there's a flip side to that, though. Again, there's this good cop, bad thing going on where I just see this pathology as just, it's like a viral strain that knows how to mutate to disguise itself. And it's, or the invasion of the body snatch, it takes on all these different forms. And so, and this would be back to the whole thing of denial of death and how it shapes our culture. It seems to me that transhumanism is showing something that the negative religious drive, as in the fear of hell that leads to a kind of pathological fanaticism that ends up kind of with a storming heaven thing behind it, like heaven at any cost, even if it means killing millions of people, that kind of drive, is also very observable in the secular population in the form of transhumanism now, among other things.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. And with all respect to the folks who work in that domain, there's a British philosopher, John Gray, who makes similar claims. He respectfully argues that it is the same underlying psychological disinclination to die that makes some people want the Pope to usher them into heaven, and other people want Google to hurry up so we can load ourselves onto a Google Cloud.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and again, giving power to these false ceremony masters who we're pretty sure cannot deliver on their promises.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I do want to talk about trauma, because that's been my main focus, but I don't want to keep dragging you into waters you're not that familiar with. So how much do you factor trauma into the terror management theory, if at all?
It is something that we are now getting to more directly. So what my colleague Tom Pazinski has been thinking about, we all have for quite some time, because we did a study a while back, it's almost 20 years ago, it was right after 2001, where we wanted to establish that death anxiety was both causally and correlationally related to psychological dissociation, which is in turn a known precursor to PTSD. Mm-hmm. And so we've done some experiments where we've shown that reminding people of their mortality increases psychological dissociation. And this has, and then we've learned a little bit about trauma. We're not experts, but I don't, to me, these are intimately related concerns, and we are now more interested in extending the range of phenomena that might be productively explored through terror management theory. We don't want to make a common mistake, and that's to pretend that our theory is the one way to look at the world, and to reduce everything through that theoretical funnel. On the other hand, we do think that it's been a productive way to think about things. And I don't think you can understand trauma without examining its connection to existential anxieties. I don't know if that's how you've been thinking about it.
Well, certainly is why I bring it up with you. Are you familiar with Joseph Chilton Pearce at all?
Yes.
I was just reminded of him while listening to you because of his research and his hypothesis that the way in which we develop an identity, I'm sure he includes trauma in there, but I'm not sure how much he centralizes trauma. But anyway, he posits a culture being against nature, this kind of struggle between culture and nature, and he tended to see culture as inherently anti-life, and that he posited that the way that we develop an identity is somehow pathological because of the adverse environment that we're growing up in as infants, and because of that we never actually, this is similar to what I was trying to articulate a moment ago, we never actually access our full life force, we never become enlightened, we never become embodied. And I bring it up now because my sense is that fear of death relates directly to this false identity, or this what's meant to be a temporary identity to protect us as children against adverse elements in society or in our environment, but that becomes fixed like a prison cell that we can't escape from, and that's the thing that fears death, essentially.
Yeah, great idea. I think it was Wilhelm Reich who referred to personality as character armor.
Yeah.
And it was the same, rather counterintuitive, but I think compelling view. And I take great liberties when I teach, because I don't consider myself a scholar. I just describe myself as a dishwasher who's read a few books. But, you know, I tell my students, look, well, the, you know, personality comes from the Latin word persona, which means mask. You know, what the psychodynamic folks point out is that, you know, that's literally true. And it's true in two ways. It's a mask that we use in order to present ourselves to the world in a certain fashion in order to garner self-esteem in the service of reducing anxiety. But it's also a shield that ironically cuts us off from our own, quote, true identity. You know, so it may seem like a contradiction in terms, but I like how some people think about it, which is that Karen Horney thinks about it this way, for example, which is, well, there's two selves. There's this basically anxiety slash trauma induced caricature of oneself. This would be the character armor. And then there is some vestigial remnant of your embodied self that gets, psychodynamically speaking, buried under the trauma-induced psychological debris of your character, and that under ideal circumstances, that's what therapy should do in principle, is to kind of, you know, brick by brick, metaphorically, get underneath the psychological rubble so that who and what you really are might have some chance of emerging. Even as an allegory, I think it's an interesting way to think about things.
Emerging from the cave of shadows.
Yes.
So, I mean, this, I can't not go here now then, which is,
oh,
what What do you think that we are then behind the mask? Or, I mean, have you thought about what we might actually be as a species and as an organism?
Yeah.
I mean, or is that too difficult a question?
No, I think about it all the time.
Yeah.
My kind of groping, incohate, it's the ultimate question. It's a great question, Jason. And all I can say is, it's back to the Norman Brown thing. And it's, is it possible to, on the one hand, be a sentient and self-conscious piece of mortal meat and have the same kind of phenomenological experience that we have from time to time as children or just watching our pets cavorting in nature? I'm kind of stuck with the, I've been preoccupied with the Hyder dude, and this will sound, Heidegger's point is that, we all have death anxiety. He called it angst, and he said most people, they flee from that anxiety. He called it a flight from death, and that he borrows Kierkegaard's term that we get tranquilized by the trivial, and that we reduce death anxiety by essentially becoming a culturally constructed meat puppet who is driven mostly by adherence to cultural dictates, and that's most individuals. But then Heidegger says, well, all right, but death anxiety could also have positive effects. And he talks about, it may be a way of summoning yourself to yourself, that maybe at times, because of our anxieties, we are able to realize explicitly or not the fabricated nature, the necessary fictions, that are of culture and of our character, and we realize that we are in many ways we're creatures that are born against our will, historically situated in a particular time and place, and thus always limited by the boundary conditions that we find ourselves in. And yet, nevertheless, we can say, all right, that's all true, but there is still some of me that would be me, even if I wasn't a professor in New York, even if I lived in a yurt and milked goats in Mongolia in the 12th century, there would be a meanness about me. Mm-hmm. And Heidegger's like, well, all right, if you ever get that far, he says, well, all right, then you get to this state. He called it anticipatory resoluteness. And he's like, all right, you're anticipating the future. So that means you've got purpose and you're looking ahead. And to be resolute, he's like, is just to have admirable determination. And that when you get in that vibe, that he's like, okay, that makes us solicitous to our fellow humans, that we actually give a shit about the people around us, and that we approach life as an ongoing adventure that gives us a sense of unshakable joy. And I remember reading these things, and I was like, God, that's like fucking Mary Poppins. What is this guy talking about? And yet, I've had very fine moments where I feel that way. And this is just my long-winded way of saying I have nothing of value or concrete to say in response to your great question. But that's what I've been thinking about lately is how can I have the best of all worlds? How can I, every day my dog wakes up and jumps around. My son's like, oh, if you look at our dog, you'd think that he's never seen food before. You know, he eats the same thing every day, and he couldn't be happier. We go on the same walk every day. It's like Nietzsche's eternal recurrence. He is just completely unencumbered by any mundane anxieties or apprehensions, and life is an ongoing succession of interesting and generally spontaneously exuberant experiences. I long to be like a dog or like a child, while at the same time, at least on occasion, maintaining the forebrain capabilities that would enable me to step back and reflect on those experiences without, you know, becoming, you know, a discombobulated pile of biological protoplasm groping for a sedative in light of my anxieties.
I know that myself, I've observed, you know, how much I do think about the future in a way that takes me out of that blissful present that you're talking about. And one thing I've noticed as I've got older is that when I do that, and I examine, or I notice that I'm doing that, I remember that the future is death. In other words, the more I project into the future, the more real my death becomes. So I wonder if there's a sort of natural check in there, that if we dissociate too much from the present, we're going to end up realizing our death, and that will snap us back into the present, right?
Absolutely. No, great. And the Heidegger dude, again, way ahead of his time, he talks about that. And his solution, again, I haven't gotten there yet, Jason, is to realize that death is not some abstraction that will befall us all at some vaguely unspecified future moment, but rather something that is always potentially imminent. And so Heidegger's point is to acquire the psychological agility to recognize in a very real sense that every now is at least in principle the last second of our existence. I haven't gotten there yet, nor have I gotten to even vaguely understand Heidegger's arguments about time. He's got like some Escher-like or Mobus strip-like conception of time as not being linear, but rather, you know, an ongoing confluence of past, present, and future kind of mingling in some, like I say, Mobus strip-like, Escher-like thing that doesn't come easily to my mind without a lot of hallucinogens.
Yeah, you just stopped my thinking there.
Yeah.
So I try to get my head around that.
No, I can't either. So let's do that another time.
Yeah. Well, I remember what I lost when you tried to take me into infinity for a second, and that was, well, there were two things. One was, and one was similar to what you're saying, I think, but one was death as an advisor. Sounds very similar, the Castaneda idea.
Yeah, I like that.
Very much about death is always there. I even had a physical
location
on our left side, and always check with death, you know, is this my death? And the answer is always going to be no until it isn't. But if when the answer is no, you realize, well, whatever I'm fretting over, it doesn't really matter in the context of that. The other thought I was having, which I knew I would want to get to at some point, which is, well, actually it's kind of new because things are changing just by talking to you, but that when we, and I said this earlier, when we think about death, we're importing it from the future, this unknown point in our future, into the present. And and of course, we're thinking about it in the context of life, obviously. So it isn't really death that we're thinking about. we're creating, maybe it's a transitional object, that's a psychological term, isn't it? But we're creating a concept of death to examine it. But like whoever who takes an animal out of the jungle to study it, it's no longer the same animal because it's out of its context.
Yes.
Yeah. So are we really contemplating death? Is one question. I don't know if it's more of a rhetorical question. The other thing that I don't know if Heidegger is getting to this or not, but, and this has haunted me for quite some time, is that mathematically, and I've tried this on a few people, some of them get it, but most of them don't. Mathematically, seeing as we're dead for infinitely longer period than we're alive, it's impossible that we would be alive in this particular moment. Mathematically speaking, have you kind of hit up against that?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, right. We're long shots to begin with.
We're infinite long shots. So that, I mean, this, I think there's some tangible evidence in that, which is eternity is reality, and we're somehow embedded in the eternal, but for whatever reason, whether it could be good or bad or a mixture of both, we've confined ourselves to this particular mind space in which we've flattened out eternity into a linear sequence,
and then that's right.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, where's this going? I suppose it's to this question that you did answer as best you could, and probably I'll have to try now. But what are we really? And if we uncovered it, and my sense, and this is based partly on this work I've been doing with a man called Dave O'Shaughnessy in Finland, who might interest you as a scientifically speaking, because he claims that in June 2000 he woke up and he knew that something had radically changed, and he didn't realize what for a time, and he was even counting his fingers like, what is it, something's different. And at a certain point he realized that his identification with the character that he had thought he was his whole life had gone, and he could no longer find it. So he just said, oh my God, I'm enlightened. That was because he'd been seeking enlightenment for his whole life, so he just put a name on it. So anyway, I've been hanging out with him, and he makes a very convincing case for enlightenment as something that isn't what it's generally described as in spiritual circles, something very simple that has to do with the life force fully landing in the body and consciousness fusing with the awareness of the body. So it's just a single thing. And his insight or his description since this happened, whatever it is that he no longer experiences himself as separate. And his awareness is that all human beings are a single life force and consciousness that is distributed through 7 billion bodies, and most of which are locked into this illusion of being individuals, and so running around trying to defend their religions and so on and so forth. So anyway, I just throw that out to you. I can't testify to that, but it feels intuitively right.
Yeah, I like it. And it jives with my sense, again, crude, but what Heidegger talks about, not with respect to anything that we've discussed so far, but his view of the world is it's like one giant force field, and we're all just pulsating entities that are interconnected. Yeah, I like that. So I'll email you, and you'll send me some specifics so I can get to know his work. I like that a lot.
Well, absolutely. You probably won't be able to get him into the lab, but you could try. He might let you hook up his brain. I don't know.
Crazy. It's the only place I feel I got to land.
I did want to actually ask you more mundane questions, actually, which was about your participation in the Planet of the Humans. I know you've been asked about this a lot, so I won't ask much detail, but I was curious about whether there's been any backlash because of the controversy that film has
stirred up. No, actually, not at all, Jason. Well, a few things. One is that I'm in the film for maybe a minute, and in some ways it comes out of nowhere and goes nowhere. I don't mean that as a movie critic. It's just that if you watch the documentary, it's unfolding, and then there's Jeff Gibbs in my office at Skidmore, and this was 4 or 5 years ago. I'm blubbering for, I think I'm literally on the screen for 90 seconds or so. And to make a short story long, Jeff interviewed me for hours that day in my office. And originally, my understanding was that where the film was going to go was to explore how death anxiety was responsible for a lot of the human affectations that made us prone to destroy the environment.
Right.
But, Jeff talked to me. I didn't hear from him for a couple of years. I didn't know at the time he spoke to me what the rest of the movie was about. And so I saw the film for the first time 2 or 3 days before it was released. And, I remember watching the movie and saying to myself, wow, this is not going to go over well.
Right.
Because it was obvious that it was going to be controversial. And so I said to myself two things. One is, wow, I wonder what people are going to say about this. And two is, when will my death threats start coming? Mm-hmm. But the fact is that I've been contacted by people around the world, dozens, not hundreds or thousands. I think 5 million people have seen the film. So most people, my presence is inconsequential. But for a few people, they're like, wow, dude, I thought your ideas were the most potent because you actually tried to explain what was going on. Mm-hmm. But when Jeff spoke to me the week that the film was, or emailed me the week that the film was released, what he said was, well, ultimately they had to make a decision or the film would be too long. And so they went with just focusing on the controversial part at the end about the green movement essentially being a front for the oil industry. And I'm not in a position to judge the merits of that argument. And not to sound defensive, but when people have asked me, well, what about the film? I'm like, well, I think it's an important film, regardless of whether or not you agree with his claims about the green movement. But I do think the movie's unfortunate in the sense that there's been too much focus on whether or not he's right about the green movement and insufficient attention to what is his overriding claim, and that is that there's no way that we can effectively manage the impending environmental apocalypse while maintaining the style of life that those of us in the West have grown accustomed to. And to me, that's the big point, is that you can't have 8 or 10 billion people on Earth all living like we do and expect to power that with windmills and wood-burning stoves. And I think that's the big point.
Sure. I guess that's something that was quite obvious even 30 years ago. So I sometimes wonder whether rational arguments reach people in the state of deep confusion that's brought about by liminality. It seems as though we're
Yeah,
getting.
no, yeah, rationality is not our default state, and it requires effort and attention and motivation. So we only lapse into rationality and coherence on occasion, myself included.
Well, what, just to maybe wind up and bring it back to David Sharma for a moment, one of the, or central to his approach is that in order to really start to perceive what's going on and be able to respond coherently, we need to relax. That everything begins with relaxation. We need to relax the nervous system and the fascia and let the life force just be, start tuning in to our bodies. Unless that happens, then we're the proverbial headless chickens.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, that's a very hard to. It seems as though that we're constantly being having the panic button pushed and given ever exponentially growing reasons to panic. Which is back to terror management, isn't it? So, do you have,
Yeah.
I guess we'll end on this, do you have a, within the context of terror management theory, do you have, this is probably too trite, but do you have something that resembles a solution or an answer as regards how to relax in the face of the certainty of our impending annihilation?
Yeah, no, I wish I did. I'd be chugging rum out of a coconut on the beach with my Nobel Prize. I agree with you. Relaxation is the key. I believe ancient wisdom, and meditational techniques that focus on breathing, and I also think, based on my gut sense of things as well as research, that there's work suggesting that mindfulness, broadly defined, is useful. Gratitude, humility, just I think being appreciative of the fact that we're alive, as mundane as this may sound. I think it's really. I think we tend to think in terms of, well, we need more sophisticated and cerebral approaches. And no, maybe we need to take a walk and a nap and chill out a bit and then go from there.
Well, that's certainly my approach. I mean, I'm trying to orientate myself more and more towards natural environments, but it's hard. I mean, this is
It is hard.
you and I wouldn't be having this conversation without the technology. So I think it, to me, a major part of it is about finding or uncovering a true sense of community and nurturing the connections that are really meaningful in our lives. And I think there's a natural kind of support system that we're embedded in as organisms that we've lost touch with as human beings, and that it's very much each other.
Yes, and a point well taken and very important, and that's that whatever's going to happen, it can't be done in isolation. We are fundamentally uber social creatures who are, moreover, as you put it, completely dependent and interdependent with all that is around us. And the sooner we can realize that and aketo those relationships to our mutual advantage, I think that's what we're going to need to do to put us on the right track.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, as up and downtown.
And then
Changes
it
in the
ended.
soul.
my conversation with Sheldon Solomon. He doesn't really have a website. If you want to find out more about him, at least buy one of his books. That was my conversation with him. 16 Maps of Hell has been completed this week again. I have rewritten it, I have transformed it, I have ascended to a whole new level of understanding. I realized I didn't even understand what the book was about or why I wrote it, but now I do, is the good news. So your support has been strangely instrumental in helping me realize the potential of this piece. So take a bow. You are the co-author of a possibly revolutionary work on the dark caverns of consciousness in which we wander dazed and confused, stumbling towards the exit. Next week's podcast will be with who? I believe it is with Luke Dodson. Yes, it is. If you want to support a hardback edition of 16 Maps of Hell, do so soon. Forever hold your peace. Changes in the stars, change with the night.